Westinghouse, pioneer in the field of radio, radar, and electronics, brings you the well-known author, war correspondent, and radio friend of millions, Ted Malone. Well, you don't have to wonder much longer what your new radio will be like, how it'll look, how it'll be better than your present set. For at Westinghouse, tomorrow's radios are in production today. They'll bring you more dependable reception, these new Westinghouse radios, and finer tone, too. For many of the new Westinghouse models will bring you FM, the newer kind of radio which is so superior in both reception and in tonal fidelity. The new Westinghouse radios will be good to look at, too, for they've been designed by leading designers and stylists. Fine console sets for the living room, many with radio phonograph combinations. Yes, for beauty, style, and the greatest in listening pleasure in radios, see your Westinghouse dealer. And now, Ted Malone.
Hello there. It doesn't seem possible that the world could change as much in the next 131 years as it has in the last. But of course, that's what the people said then, too, and believed it. 131 years ago last night, a young lawyer named Francis Scott Key anxiously paced the deck of a boat in the Bay of Baltimore, waiting to see whether the British Navy, firing on Fort McHenry, had destroyed it during the night. Out of that battle fought 131 years ago last night, our national anthem was born. It's an interesting story. Maybe you'll feel different about some things if you'll listen. Nearly every country has its national anthem. Canada has three official songs. China's was written by its most distinguished elder statesman, Dr. Sun Yat-sen. The words are taken from a poem he wrote for a speech to a Chinese military academy in 1928. Great Britain has been singing God Save the King since 1745. Nobody knows for sure who wrote it way back there. Some say a court musician to James I, John Bull, a most appropriate name anyway. The words to Mexico's national anthem, Himno Nacional, come from the winning poem in a Mexican government competition between 25 poets. The Netherlands' national anthem has 15 verses, the first letters of each verse making an acrostic spelling William of Netherlands. Russia formerly used the International as its song, but this has been changed. The official national anthem of Soviet Russia, adopted May 15, 1944, is called the Hymn of the Soviet Union. One of the most familiar foreign national anthems is the French Marseillaise, written words and music by Rouget de Lisle in 1792. While it was written for the French Revolution, it was written of the mayor of Strasbourg, host at a party de Lisle attended. The composer went home, took out his violin, and in 6 hours wrote the words and music to one of the most stirring anthems ever written. Where did it get its name? That's an odd twist. A regiment of soldiers from Marseille heard it, liked it, and sang it wherever they went. And the people thought it was written in Marseille, so named it for the picturesque city on the Mediterranean. The Germans are confused at present. Deutschland, Deutschland über alles is still the official anthem, but Hitler and the Nazi Party adopted Horst Wessel, which Horst Wessel wrote himself, so no one is quite sure which is which. It really doesn't make much difference just now anyway. Neither one is particularly popular. Italy's national anthem, to a good many sopranos, seems to be the Italian street song. Actually, it is Giovinezza, translated youth, a drinking song, marching song of the Italian army of the last war, adopted by the fascists in this. It's one of the liveliest and happiest of all the national anthems. Japan, Rosa says, should adopt a new one. I surrender, dear. But for the record, it's a little number called Kimegayu, translated In the Reign of the Emperor. And by the way, the Japs have the oldest of all national anthems. It dates back to the 9th century. America didn't have any real song the first half of its existence. Some sang the British God Save the King, until a chap named Smith wrote our present words for America in the 1830s. Some sang Yankee Doodle. Stephen Foster's Oh, Susanna was the most popular song in the 40s. But the song that eventually became our national anthem dates back to a night in September 1814, with bombs bursting in air over Fort McHenry, 131 years ago last night. As a background for that story, maybe I should remind you a little of the man who wrote it. Francis Scott Key was born August 1st, 1799, on a plantation near Pipe Creek, Maryland. The Revolutionary War was going full swing at the time, and the elder Key was a lieutenant in the cavalry. As the years passed, young Key helped around the plantation, went to school, and his worst vice seemed to be a penchant for writing poetry. Apparently, at an early age, he announced he was going to be a lawyer, and so his schooling was continued at St. John's College in Annapolis. The poems he wrote during his undergraduate days didn't make much of an impression on the ones for whom they were written, as Polly Lloyd, the light of his life, used them for curler papers. Graduated from college when he was 21, he was admitted to the bar and began to practice law at Fredericktown, Maryland. When he was 23, Francis Scott Key went back to Annapolis, proposed to Polly Lloyd, was accepted, married her, and they set up housekeeping in Fredericktown. In the years that followed, young Key became a distinguished lawyer. Then in the summer of 1814, something happened. Seems that most of the British troops had retreated after their punitive expedition burning Washington, but that some three stragglers had been captured or arrested by a Dr. Beans of Bladensburg. And the indignant British, learning of this, sent back a company which not only released the stragglers, but captured the unfortunate Dr. Beans. So, Secretary of State Monroe summoned Skinner, an officer in charge of the exchange of prisoners, and Key to plead the case of the old doctor, and sent them down the Bay of Baltimore under a flag of truce. Party succeeded in contacting the British, and Key presented his case. And Dr. Beans was turned over to Key and Skinner, and the party prepared to start back. But at the last moment, they were denied permission to leave. The British were planning a night attack on Fort McHenry, and since Key and Skinner, as well as Dr. Beans, had heard some of the plans while aboard the British man of war, they had to remain in custody until the battle was over. Over in Baltimore, the defenders of Fort McHenry had been expecting an attack for some time. Brigadier General Stricker had asked the young widow, Mary Pickersgill, to make a new flag for the fort, a big one, 29 feet long, 36 feet wide. The stars themselves were to be 2 feet high. The only place available big enough to cut the bunting and lay it out and sew it was the warehouse of Claggett's Brewery, and there, Widow Pickersgill and her little daughter Carolyn worked nights for a week sewing the 15 stars on the blue field with 15 red and white stripes. That's right, 15 stripes. On the night of the 12th, it was finished. On the night of the 13th, the battle began. The American party under the flag of truce had grandstand seats for the whole battle on a small ship out in the bay, but all they could do was watch. All night the ships poured broadside after broadside into Fort McHenry overlooking the water. One shell made a direct hit on the flag, tearing out some of the stars. A British gunner told Key to watch and see they'd all be gone by morning. Before dawn, a landing party set out with hooks and scaling ladders, but all night long, the cannons studding the fort boomed out, giving the attackers broadside for broadside. Whether Francis Scott Key actually wrote the Star-Spangled Banner on the boat the next morning or in his hotel in Baltimore, or whether it was first printed in a newspaper or on a handbill or sung in a hotel or a music hall doesn't make much difference. He did watch through the perilous night, through the rockets' red glare and the bombs bursting in air, and in the morning, well, you know the story. Francis Scott Key went back to Fredericktown to Polly and the children. He must have told her all that happened. Probably read her the poem. He called it Defense of Fort McHenry. And she may have remembered all the poems he'd written to her when she was a girl, and she used them for curling papers. She may have been a little sorry she'd laughed at them. But I'm sure she couldn't know that in the years to come, millions of people from different lands, of different customs and different creeds, would be welded together into a great nation through the strength and inspiration of the words of this poem. I stood in Paris one afternoon about a year ago when a parade came by with a dozen bands playing, everybody laughing, shouting, when suddenly a half-hundred clear-eyed young Americans stepped snappily along the street, raised their instruments, began the Star-Spangled Banner. In a half a minute, the crowd was hushed. French people, refugees from a dozen countries, and Americans, all quiet until the last notes. And then, it was as though a storm of applause burst from all sides. The people went wild. This was the music of the people of a free country, America.
Ted Malone will be back in just a moment with today's postscript. You know, radio's newest network features no name bands or comedians, carries no commercials. It's guaranteed never to have more than a dozen listeners. It consists of six FM transmitters, five of them on diesel locomotives and the sixth on the roof of the East Pittsburgh Westinghouse plant, which was the scene of radio's first scheduled broadcast back in 1920, the birthplace of KDKA. The network, which has a range of only 15 miles, speeds up the switching of freight on the railroad lines at various Westinghouse plants. It also gives Westinghouse a unique practical laboratory to study FM radio, which will be an important factor in future broadcasting. Many of the new radio sets now in production at Westinghouse will have built-in FM band in order to give you the superb tonal quality and reception which this newer form of radio offers. Others will be radio phonograph combinations. All will be radios unexcelled for quality, performance, and style, worthy to bear the name Westinghouse. Yes, for the finest in listening enjoyment, look to Westinghouse. And now here's Ted Malone with today's postscript.
No, not a postscript today, Chappie. It's the whole program. The Star-Spangled Banner, originally called The Defense of Fort McHenry, was written by Francis Scott Key to be sung to the tune of an old English drinking song of unknown vintage. Its composer is unknown. And although President Wilson, by executive order in 1916, declared it to be our national anthem, this did not become official until Congress passed a law and it was signed in May 1931. In May 1931, the Star-Spangled Banner became the national anthem of the United States. Today, on this, the 131st anniversary of its birthday, ladies and gentlemen, the national anthem.
Ted Malone comes to you at this time every day, Monday through Friday, brought to you by Westinghouse, maker of more than 30 million appliances for the American home. Until Monday at the same time, this is Ernest Chappell saying goodbye for Westinghouse. Just a brief reminder, poor light means strained sight, work undone, impaired vision. Protect your sight with the right light, and for the right light, get Westinghouse bulbs. Yes, for seeability, insist on the quality bulb, Westinghouse bulbs.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.